Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Horrible Podcast. I'm Brian.
I'm Tyler.
And I'm Drew.
And thank you, Venomous Maximus, for our theme song, Drip Can.
How did you try the hot sauce? I forgot to ask you.
I haven't opened it yet.
You haven't?
No.
It can be like a collector's item.
He keeps forgetting to bring the one that's good for pizza over, and we've had pizza three times.
Have you?
Drew's trying to give me a hint. I'm not taking it. I'm not good at hints, guys.
Well, every week you could just be like, man, this pizza is good, but it could be hotter. It could be hotter.
Next time, Drew, on Tuesday, just go, Brian, bring the hot sauce.
That would require me to remember it as
well. Yeah, that's the problem.
You don't remember, like, it's funny, you're holding it over his head, but you don't remember it until you forgot, and you're like, am I missing? This pizza's missing. Oh, hot sauce. Which one is supposedly the one that's good for pizza?
Flaming Lips.
Flaming Lips.
Okay.
So it's got pineapple and habanero, I think you said?
Yeah, I think so.
Man, habanero is good. I like hot stuff. Brian, are you one of those, like, I like super hot things? I can't remember.
I will eat hot stuff. I usually regret it the next morning.
Or like...
I know what Johnny Cash was talking about when he wrote Ring of Fire, if you know what I mean.
Oh.
I like hot stuff, too.
I was being like your Ed McMahon there.
Oh, I got
you. Yeah.
I thought you were literally telling me no, not to talk. No, like, Brian, stop.
Oh. No, yeah.
He does.
For me, it's usually not the next morning. It's like 10 a.m. when I'm trying to actually get things done, and it hits. I'm like, fuck. Why?
The sweats.
Why did I eat that? I knew this would be the result. I did that with Chipotle last week, where I was like, yeah, it gave me the hottest sauce, too. Dumb.
I find, like, I've had a couple of habanero spiced beers.
Right.
And at the time, like, oh, man, this is so good. And then, like, that night when I start burping,
ugh.
I'm like, oh, God, it's the worst burn ever.
It's awful.
And to play so we can do it, habanero limerita. It's pretty tasty.
Yeah?
Yeah.
One of Kate's friends was like, how do I get rid of sinus problems? And I said, habanero beer. That will burn everything out of your nostrils.
Was the habanero limerita, is that a sponsored thing or was that homemade?
It was homemade. I mean, it was a limerita because they had mangaritas and the others, but the habanero side of it was something they did there. The taqueria tsunami.
How quickly I've gotten out of that world. I'm like, I don't know things.
I don't know too much alcohol. Let's go to Asheville.
I know the irony of it. I'm going for the
seriously
hike
though.
Mount Mitchell. That's where I want to go.
National Park. That was pretty fun.
Well, Mount Mitchell's the highest peak east of the Mississippi. So if I went, that's what I would want to do is hike that.
And then we went and I swam in a waterfall, and I can't remember the name of the waterfall, but it was pretty fun.
Did you jump out of the water and like swing your head back so that your hair flung everywhere beautifully?
What do you think?
you Bo Derek'd it?
I think yes. Well, he is a perfect 10.
Thank you.
Or is it? It's just 10. It's not perfect 10. Damn it.
It's just 10, yeah.
It's just 10.
Unfortunately, Asheville is in North Carolina because I'm the only 10 you see. I tried.
What?
Tennessee. Tennessee.
Tennessee. Yeah.
Hey, guys, if you want to follow us, we're on Twitter. At Horrible PCast, HORRORBULLPCAST.
And one of the good things about our podcast is we don't harass other people online. We're not one of those, like, Twitter is famous for being full of assholes who like to make other people cry, and we don't do that. Except with tears of laughter.
But nobody will respond.
That's the sad part is that other people are able to actually get to people and make them cry. People just ignore us, even when we try to make them cry.
It's a real honest effort, though.
Yeah,
I just like, I'm gonna go fuck with this guy over here who just followed us. Hey, asshole! Thanks for the follow.
What did I do?
Also,
mom called.
Check out the podcast on iTunes and rate and review it. That's the big thing, so that we got to get some heat, man. So we can, you know,
we need that hot sauce heat.
Yeah, we need that
habanero heat.
Yeah, we want that habanero heat. So go rate and review the podcast, and that's
the Horrible Podcast. We're good when we eat, we burn coming out.
How can we improve that? I don't know.
We'll workshop it later.
Later, we'll come up with our habanero themed like spikes of ads.
Speaking of a focus group together.
Yeah, we could focus group our own ads.
Speaking of things that aren't hot, cold in July.
Boom.
Yeah.
Don't need to workshop that.
It is. It is hot.
Really hot. It's super hot.
Especially in Texas, where this movie takes place. That's it.
I have to say that this is one of my favorite movies we've ever watched on the podcast. And I don't know that I would have ever watched it without the podcast, but I'm so glad that we did.
Does, even though it's not a, I mean, it's technically not a horror film, it is directed by a horror director, which is Jim Mickle, who has done both Stakeland and
We Are What We Are.
So, of which Nick D'Amici shows up in all three movies.
Well, he co-wrote all of them.
This one. And Joe Lansdale.
Apparently,
wrote this short story.
Well, it's why it's why I'd sit there and say, I'd argue that, I mean, at times, you know, we've said that exploitation is kind of where we go. And I think that this definitely, like Blue Ruin, fits in that revenge exploitation-y kind of vein of I guess, I wouldn't say 70s era. This is definitely 80s era film, thriller at least.
It's kind of like if, for me, it's like if 8mm were done by the guys who made Hotline Miami.
Or Michael Mann.
Yeah.
I was thinking, there's a lot of Manhunter in this.
Yeah, if 8mm were made by Michael Mann, like mid-80s Michael Mann. I like that.
Wait, rather than Joel Schumacher, then it's already a good movie.
Basically, I mean...
Do you think
Hotline Miami is basically a Michael Mann video game from the mid-80s, you know?
Yeah.
Do you think Michael Mann's eventual biopic will be called Manhunter, M-A-N-N-H-U-N-T-E-R?
Or maybe it could be called Man Up.
Guys, I'm just going to throw ideas out. Some of them stick, some of them fall away.
Yeah.
You know? That's what you get. I kept feeling like this was a Coen Brothers movie.
Could be.
Too. It felt Coen Brothers.
A very Blood Simple kind of thing going on.
I think that Manhunter, M-A-N-N Hunter, would be the unauthorized biography that you would find, like they used to do for, like, I'm sure they still do those unauthorized biographies that really are worthless, but that would be it would have, like, a really odd picture of him on the front with a really bad Photoshop job and a background that totally doesn't fit the tone of the book.
I hate myself and I want to die. The Kurt
Cobain story,
It would look like that poster for Manhunter, like that 80s poster for Manhunter that's all like Andy Warhol's version of William Peterson or something.
Right.
It's the equivalent of the hair cutteries from the 80s, that two-tone.
Oh.
Kyle doesn't know what we're talking about. I never went to a hair place in the 80s.
I don't know what a hair cuttery is.
Well, there used to be a store called the Hair Cuttery.
A charcuterie.
The Hair Cuttery.
You get your hair cured there.
Hey,
your hair comes out saltier.
Someone needs to start that store. That place in Athens is the Hair Cuttery.
The Hair Cuttery. People would go in wanting the wrong thing, I feel like, based on the second syllable.
We're going to prepare your hair the best we can.
We're going to put your hair in sand. I guess a hipster place when we're gonna put your hair in sand.
Right? We're gonna put some mayo on it. And maybe
it'll be a sand aioli, and it will be topped with chive.
There'll be a liver mousse in there somewhere.
Oh yeah.
All right. So Cold in July is honestly one of my favorite movies we've ever done for the podcast. And yeah, it definitely fits into the exploitation vibe, which we have veered into. I mean, going all the way back, I mean, Eaten Alive is equal parts like a horror movie and exploitation. That was our first episode. So I think this also fits into that. It has a retro vibe, but it doesn't linger on the nostalgia too much. It just sort of uses it as a backdrop. Like Brian said, like a Coen Brothers movie. Like the Coen Brothers don't set movies in places in order to make people go, oh, I remember how the 80s were, but just to have a slight change of reality. Like it's just a twist on reality. And this movie has that.
And also helped out immensely by Jeff Grace's score.
Oh, yeah.
For this movie. A great score.
It's amazing. It's an amazing soundtrack.
And the font.
Yes, the font.
It's Carpenter font.
And not just that. Well, Jeff Grace's music is very 80s Carpenter-esque inspired too. That very low key, the constant kind of.
What was weird was that it didn't seem.
That's good.
I'm gonna drop the bass. Wow.
What's weird is it didn't the tone of the music didn't fit the tone of the movie, but I like that it was sort of like it played counter to the movie itself. You know, like it felt more realistic when there was sort of shit kicker country in it or old blues, right. But the sort of like atonal, like beating rhythmic 80s sort of like. Not Vangelis, but who did the Miami Vice theme song? Who was that?
Jan Hammer. Yeah.
I called it Jan Hammer for so Jan many Hammer. Years.
Well, because at that point I didn't really know how to pronounce those names, so it was Jan Hammer.
And until you said Jan Hammer a second ago, I still thought it was Jan Hammer.
We just changed Tyler's life.
He's like, I'm on speed by Jan DeBont.
Yeah.
Ooh.
What?
Not nothing.
Okay.
I also called him, instead of Yanni, Johnny. I didn't do that. So
his name was with a Y.
I know. But the
it's a soft J in Swedish.
Yes, because it's a Y.
He was.
The problem with Cold in July is the only thing that's difficult about that movie is that it's hard to describe the movie to other people without ruining sort of the early twist in it, because I actually think my girlfriend would like this movie. She likes thrillers, but I didn't want to give away the interesting sort of third of the way through twist. So I was just like, it's about a guy who accidentally kills a guy in his own house. And then
and that's how you have to end it, because
yeah.
If you go any further, you're like, yeah. You are literally giving away the scares and stuff like that. Cause you know, they're not that way. And Sam Shepard, pretty fucking intense.
He's scary. Yeah.
He's amazing in this movie.
Like when the twist came, and like after about 15 minutes after we got, the last half of the movie, last two thirds of the movie, I kept thinking, I was like, is Michael C. Hall never going to address the fact that Sam Shepard was ready to kill him and his family at any moment?
Well, the thing I think this movie does super well too is that most movies. It's weird how movies that come out today aren't able to transition out of genres very well. Like, this started as sort of a, you know, stranger in my house sort of movie, where it's like, how am I going to, like, protect my home? Like, I thought that was going to be what the movie was going to be about. But then it transitioned this whole other sort of, like, buddy cop, 8mm-y kind of weird movie set in the 80s. And most movies aren't able to do that, to turn into another kind of movie, because usually when you watch them, you are with one half, and then when it changes, you're like, oh, I didn't like how it changed. But this movie, I was with it during both parts. I was like, I almost had that moment when he pulled him from the train tracks, where I was like, I don't think I want to see where this movie goes. But then almost immediately, I was like, yes, I'm in. This is awesome. Sam Shepard is fantastic here.
And it's actually, you know, I'd go even so far as to say it's three different films. Like, yeah. The acts are three different acts. Mm-hmm. We have the creepy Stranger in My House vibe.
The Cape Fear vibe.
Cape Fear. I mentioned that.
The, okay, well, that wasn't my son. Now it becomes a mystery of what's happening. And then the third act, it's almost like a revenge.
It's Taxi Driver.
Like. Yeah, so it really does a good job switching gears twice.
Yeah.
I think you have Cape Fear, Killer Joe, and Blue Ruin is what you kind of have.
Yeah,
I
mean, sure. Yeah, I'll take that, yeah.
Feelings of all of those films. Mm-hmm.
Especially of recent movies, and I definitely got the Taxi Driver vibe at the end when the guy gets shot and he's just screaming in that sort of way that the guy in Taxi Driver does, like, "You crazy son of a bitch!
You son of a bitch!
I'll kill you! I'll kill you! I'll kill you!"
Made famous by Pantera's The Badge.
I know that's how I know. You know, I didn't watch Taxi Driver until I was in my late teens, and so I just thought that was some random thing they pulled from. I had no idea it was from Taxi Driver.
I think it's funny, though, that you just said that, like, late teens, like, you know, as cinephiles, as we all three are, some, you know, that to feel like you're almost embarrassed to say you didn't see something until you were 19. It's like, a lot of people haven't seen that movie still.
Right? I know.
And you're like, oh man, I didn't see this until this. And it's like, well, we've already seen, you know, 1,000% more movies than most people.
Yeah, it is weird as a cinephile. Like, oh, I didn't see Taxi Driver until I was like 14, you know?
Like, we watch a lot of movies, and I mean, and even our buddy Chris, it's like, oh, what'd you do? I was like, I watched these three movies last night. It's like, what the fuck? I can't keep up with you.
I know.
I have to stop trying.
It does. I mean, it does help to like with, for example, have you guys played PT yet?
Yes.
I've only watched it. I think we talked about it sort of last week. Damn it. There's a part I want to talk about, and it relates to a movie. Okay, I won't.
See, he's watched a walkthrough.
Have you watched a walkthrough?
I read some of the stuff, but then I stopped. But I didn't read
any
of it.
All right,
Did you read anything about a baby, Drew? Something.
No.
Okay.
I didn't read too much about it.
That was a red herring. There isn't a baby, so I'm just saying.
I mean, I'll survive.
Anyway, it does help to be a cinephile. And like, I think the reference of that part. Yeah, I think it helps, especially with movies like this. It kind of makes us snobs because we're saying that we enjoy this movie because we understand the other movies it kind of references. So I can't divorce myself from the idea of like, I like this movie because it's a good movie, but also I like this movie because of all the things that it makes me think of as well. Like, I don't know how many people I know would love this movie just in absence of other movies that like it relates to.
I mean, Gina really liked it. I remember that. I mean, she had just...
Okay. And we all know Gina doesn't know anything about the movie.
She's seen a lot more stuff now, but yeah, I don't know to go from there. I liked Steak Land and I liked We Are What We Are, but it feels light years away from those movies.
Yeah, this, like, I mean, you mean as far as in terms of quality?
Well, yeah, just for what Mikkel was able to accomplish and, you know, and completely pull off. It's like, while I liked those other two movies and I thought they had a lot of successful things in them, I thought that they weren't quite as successful as the ideas in them were, maybe.
I thought this was
stylistic and narrative, you know, stylistically and narratively successful on every level. I mean, it didn't hurt that you also had Michael C. Hall, Sam Shepard, and Don Johnson that you were dealing with. That was helpful.
Don Johnson is just fucking things up here lately, isn't he? But, like, he's just amazing.
Acting, and it's not just that they were in this movie and we like them. They were acting their asses off. Like, all three of them were chewing up the scenery like nobody's, especially Don Johnson. He was amazing at chewing up the scenery in this movie.
I was really waiting for a little heartbeat to play on the radio or something.
That would have been amazing. If Mikkel could have pulled that off, that would have been, I just stood up and clapped at night. Just, yes.
Why do you think Don Johnson had so much trouble like transitioning out of, do you think he was just a TV actor? Like, he never was able to like transition to movie stardom?
Well, I think that, I mean, it's, you know, going back to even Travolta with Pulp Fiction, it's like they became almost caricatures of themselves, and people forgot that they were actually, before they became these huge stars that were known for these big movies,
huge.
Like, you know, Travolta
or
in
Travolta's
movies, Don Johnson
case,
and,
huge. It was a huge movie star.
Well, it was a huge movie star.
I don't know about Don Johnson being this big.
But, I mean, Miami Vice was massive in the, I mean,
yeah.
That,
yeah. No, it was. So he's David Caruso,
right? So, but and people,
except he didn't ruin his own career,
right? Yeah,
right.
David Caruso quit way too early.
But you know, when you were in, I mean, he was influencing what people wore,
yeah,
you know, stuff like that. You had, oh, you certainly. Become, you know, you, you know, what is it? What's the Batman thing? It's like you either die young or you live long enough to
become a villain or something.
Become
like
a villain, yeah.
You die here or live long enough to become a villain or whatever.
So I think we got past that, and then what would happen to are people that are from the generation that grew up with them, Tarantino,
Mikkel, I guess, yeah,
who have loved them and their characters, they gave them the chance because, I mean, they had to be actors before they became these huge movie stars. So, you know, John Travolta maybe
still problematic with this Don Johnson as giant movie star.
Let me just say,
as a giant star. I mean, Don Johnson is still a huge touchstone for like. If you think of a pink T-shirt and white blazer, Don Johnson's the only person you will think of.
Yeah, exactly. They were, for a time, larger than life.
Yeah.
All right. No, I don't know that. I think that is ultimately, though, why Don Johnson is where he is now, though, is Don Johnson's very limited in what he is able to do. And I think this movie plays greatly to what strengths he does have.
You know what movie?
He's getting Tin Cup.
That's
as well.
What I'm saying. That's the movie that got like that brought him back for me too. Was like he was amazing in Tin Cup.
Wonderful.
That was like his assholishness compared to like you know with Kevin Costner's assholishness. Like they complement each other well. Yeah, that was a good movie.
I mean, that's the thing. There's a certain thing you can do. I mean, essentially, this character he played in this is the exact same person he played as Kenny Powers' dad. I mean, that's what I kept thinking at the time. And I mean, not to take anything away from how he did, he was fantastic at it, right. but it's pretty much the same. I was feeling like that's what he must have done on his off weekends was, you know, come and be this private detective.
But also, I mean, people are able to build careers on their machismo. And it seems like it's weird that he wasn't able to translate to even a limited like film career out of this. Well, I know it's not The Adventures of Ford Fairlane. What was the Private Eye show that he had in the 90s? I think Cheech Marin was in it. Yeah, Nash Bridges. And
it lasted for several seasons.
There was a couple years where whenever I thought of the Bridges brothers, I had to say like Nash Bridges is not one of those brothers. I was like, it's Bo and Jeff. And Nash. Jeff, Bo, and Nash Bridges. But no, I mean, he is a cultural touchstone. I mean, in Rockstar, I mean, all of Vice City is based on him, more or less. And, you know, I don't know. I think this performance was just revelatory in a way. Like, I can't believe how much he was just able to step in and just do this thing and be almost a self-parody without actually being a self-parody. Because a lot of people, and I think Tom Cruise doesn't do this very well. Like I didn't necessarily enjoy his turn in Tropic Thunder. I thought it was too much, like too overt and obvious. And it went into parody too much. But this was just like on that line, like walking that line of being almost a parody of a character, but also being really interesting and tough as well.
I think you're right about Tom Cruise. I listened to his Nerdist podcast, and the whole time I was listening to it, I kept thinking, it's like, this guy has no idea what it's like to be a regular human being.
Oh, and certainly doesn't.
Yeah. He has no clue. And
he hasn't been a regular human being since, what, 1980?
Right, and I'm like, well,
six?
Top
Gun. Maybe right, but like the day before Top Gun was released.
He's like, can I afford these jeans?
Yeah, he saw his last sunset as a regular human being, and then that was it. He didn't even realize it.
And, you know, it's like, I mean, that's just his life. I can't hate the guy because that's how he's become. It's just he has no idea what it's like to live a normal life. Mm-hmm. But Johnson probably got a little taste of it, and he's probably like, oh, I probably should just, you know.
Don Johnson to me this is going to be a weird analogy, but I really like the movie The Replacements. And Keanu Reeves' character of sitting on a boat, like scraping the barnacles off the sides of boats, I just imagine that's what Don Johnson's 90s was like. As much as he was a star in the 80s, like him just sort of going like, eh, fuck it, I'm going to drink a beer. Like, that's
when
what I imagine his 90s.
He and Melanie Griffith divorced, he probably did live on a boat for a short time.
Probably.
I'm sure he did.
Oh, he had to have lived on a boat.
And then Nash Bridges came along, and he lived on a bigger boat.
Yeah, he's like, well, I get that.
Except he had to hang out with Cheech.
He's like, now I can get rid of that. Now I can just use the bathroom in the country club. I don't have to keep going on my boat.
Or off the side of it. So, all right, Colton.
Welcome to the Don Johnson podcast.
I mean, well, he's
central to my love of like how this movie transitions to a kick-ass second and third act almost exclusively to Don Johnson's performance.
Michael C. Hall, I never feel at ease when he's on the screen. He mm-hmm. makes me so nervous.
Me too. That's weird. Why do you think that is?
I mean, I've seen him in 6 Feet Under.
Yeah,
I've seen him in Dexter, and he plays completely different characters in those movies.
But I mean, David still always had an edge to him, like he was always about to explode.
Yeah, that's what it is. He feels like he's always on the verge of explosion, and that works in this movie because you think like, well, he is on the verge of explosion because he's always got this shit happening to him.
No, because of the hair.
Yeah.
It was the perfect 80s hair, late 80s when the mullet had just gone out. I mean. People in my high school had mullets, guys, and they were not ironic. They were for real, and people loved them.
Which I think is why it's such a great casting choice, because with people from like really rural southern areas, there is this sort of border, like just under the surface, seething hatred for no reason in some people, and he personifies that so well of like, I don't have a reason to be angry, but there's a little part of me that is always angry. And he does that so well. Like his life is normal. He has just a normal sort of uneventful life until this moment. But you know, like the way that he plays that character is that there is something there or else he would not follow this, like go down this rabbit hole for almost no reason.
Right.
And did he do a frame store? Is that what he?
Well, yeah. When he said he was a framer, I was like, oh, he must work on like framing houses and stuff like that. Yeah, and then I was like, oh no, he's literally a. Which I imagine a store. in a small Texas town, work that's as close as you get to art school. Art school. Fags,
also,
whole idea of that art school idea is like that's like, oh well, you're framing pictures there, son.
Well, that's the person who does that in a small town is the person who was the kind of frustrated artist, and we don't see that in his character, but you have to assume that he probably was because the person who becomes. Who does that for a living in a small town.
But he also made sure he put the idea that he was the gay art guy in town by marrying hot-ass Vanessa Shaw.
Right.
What's weird is
that... who started with Eyes Wide Shut with Tom Cruise.
This movie... I mean, he that is a weird metaphor because he works as a frame guy and he is the one who is framed... in a weird way, in this movie,
That's a good. That's a good point. Yeah. Did you write that down, or did you just think of that?
Just thought of it now as we talked about it because you said framer. I was like, oh, he was framed. I just changed one word. One letter, the R to a D.
And it's what was cool is like you don't know how deep the local police were instrumental in making all of this look like it was this certain person died and made sure it. Which later I understood what Don Johnson was getting at when he showed Sam Shepard all those paper clippings. Like they wanted to make sure people knew he was gone.
It was, I mean, and the movie is not really even about that, which I love. Like it just sort of in another movie, it might have been seen as a huge flaw that they don't sort of wrap this up in a super satisfying way. But here, the movie's not about that. It's kind of like Jaws in that it's not about what's actually happening. It's about how these characters interact. And I think that's what I love about it, is that it's just sort of them being brooding, frustrated, middle-aged to elderly men. And that's something I love about something. It.
They accomplish something, finally.
And it goes back to the whole idea that Michael C. Hall does not confront Sam Shepard about what he was going to do to them if he still thought it was his son.
That's a good point. I didn't think it.
Well, one of the things I loved is at the very beginning was when one of the best things when they said, oh, and his dad's just out of prison. You're like, are you kidding me? That's like the worst news you can have about that guy you just supposedly shot. Oh, his dad just got out of prison. He's a bad dude. He just got out of prison. Art, really great. He's out.
Let me ask a question. Between this movie and True Detective, do they still make Lone Star beer?
Yeah.
Because I totally want to try it now.
Yeah, I used to drink it down at Flickr a lot.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Huh.
Because under it, you flip off the tab and it has the little symbol.
The Yellow Roads of Texas?
No. No, it's like a... God, what is it? Does it have
a
like
star?
A lone star? Like a card, like a hand at cards or something like that. Something of that nature. I can't remember now. I haven't had one in a while. I just liked how there's a movie that was like it was not set in the 80s. It was made in the 80s.
Yeah,
that's how it felt. Yeah, you know, it didn't feel like that general thing you get where it's like, oh look, we are to be in the 1980s.
They did even not draw, but that's the thing. It's like if we hadn't known that it took place in the 80s, I could have totally believed this was present day Texas.
I mean, I feel like this
except
movie's
the VHS
more,
and the Pinto.
I think this movie's more authentically 80s. Than say, No Country for Old Men. There's always something about the way that the Coen brothers do their period pieces that make it feel very like overtly about the time period.
Right.
Even though it's all in the background, it feels like we're doing these really odd things on purpose. This had some odd touches, but it still felt more organically 80s than most movies that are made today that are meant to be about the 80s or another sort of recent decade. And well, that's what I like about it.
The inclusion of White Lion's Wait, which is actually on the soundtrack too.
Awesome.
But I thought, man, I don't know if that's the 80s, 'cause I would totally include that song in a movie now. Wait.
Well, I think that was another thing that helped, though, is also it's not a movie that the entire soundtrack was filled with. Here are these songs from the 80s that you know.
Yeah.
There is Thompson Twins and, Missing Persons.
Well, like what you get with every comedy that's trying to be, the Take Me Home Tonights and, things like that. You know,
oh, yeah.
Everyone
yeah.
dresses like
it's
Don
like,
Johnson.
Oh, God, we all dress this way. It's funny.
It's why that show, that 80s show, didn't work, is it that it was just... a series of sight gags about the 80s. And
hey, that 80s show starred Glenn Howerton, star of Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
And Brittany Daniel?
God.
Was that the Daniel sister?
I think so.
She's on, who is also on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia as a transsexual, transvestite.
Yes. Hey, you know who's missing from this? Michael Rooker. What's Michael Rooker in all this? Because you Michael Rooker is just on the outside of all of these events.
If I be honest with you,
he's just on the outside of the camera going, oh, I just Jimmy tripped yeah. me.
Do it, boys.
Just write me a script.
I'd be honest, rolling the script. I bet you money they went to Michael Rooker before Sam Shepard and he was doing Guardians of the Galaxy because he couldn't do this. Because I could totally see Michael Rooker in that role.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely, 100.
What I got to do, boy, is do.
Not quite old enough, but yeah, I mean, total aesthetic. Also, side note that I was looking on the Comcast box this weekend looking at they had all these movie collections, and I don't remember why Days of Thunder. I don't remember why it was on there, but Days of Thunder, and I don't know if the transfer was shitty or if they just wanted you to feel like you're watching a VHS trailer, but the trailer for Days of Thunder, I don't know why anyone went to see movies that were made in the 80s or 90s because the trailers were shitty, awful.
I don't know. I still remember Days of Thunder very, very positive.
I love that movie, that but that trailer too. In retrospect is weird and terrible.
Right, yeah.
Seeing the Days of Thunder trailer, I was amazed. I immediately wanted to see it. I cannot. The trailer that I remember the most that had the most effect on me in the 80s was the fucking Top Gun trailer.
Oh yeah,
I can still remember to this day going, "Holy shit!"
Yeah, that movie's amazing.
We just back to back Tony Scott movies there.
R.I.P. Tony Scott.
R.I.P. Tony Scott. Yeah.
But yeah, so that in Labyrinth when they had they showed the scene of David Bowie walking upside down with everything I've done for you. I move the stars for no one.
Is that okay? That is him. I guess that's him. I guess that's David Bowie.
Everything I've done for you. I move the stars for no one. Sarah.
Okay.
All right.
Thumbs up.
Oh, it's Virginia and Elton John territory.
Everything I've done
that's,
for you.
Yeah, that's definitely Elton John.
I move the star, no one.
I wasn't as into the first act. I thought it would be...
starring Elton John. The piano. He's just at the piano the whole time. Like,
crazy. His crazy glasses.
When Sarah comes in the castle, it breaks into the bitch's
Sarah.
Back.
Sarah!
The bitch is back. Sorry.
And I was with the first act of the movie, but infinitely better once we get past the skin of the conspiracy where we get like, oh, something's not right here. That's where I was really into this movie. And yeah. once you realize, oh, this is going to, I thought it was going to be a kid. I didn't know what it was going to turn to. I was like, is this going to be a kidnapping movie? Is going to keep Sam Shepard here? But he almost immediately lets him go. And then they're off. Like it. And then the next scene, when you see Don Johnson when he gets out of that giant red Cadillac with the steer horns, like the most stereotypical Texas thing, I still got chills. Like, this is gonna be awesome, and it was.
I always want. As I was watching that, I was thinking to myself, I was like, I mean, he's doing some private, you know, PI work. Is that the most inconspicuous car you can find for PI work? I also thought that, and in the truck when they're waiting. When they're kind of staking out the house and the video store, I kept thinking, I was like, I know those guys have to see you over there. There's three grown men shoved into a truck.
Into like an S10 or something. Like,
yeah.
Can you find a bigger thing to drive in? You could rent a car for a day.
That's the 80s are where, you know, Kitty Fiddler vans came from. They hadn't then.
They sort of appeared in a portal in the 80s and went away in 1991. And that's where all of them came from. And you just have to, if you want to be a Kitty Fiddler, you just have to get one from 1991.
I mean, that was the worst Stephen King short story I ever read.
Kitty Fiddler?
Kitty
Fiddler. No one about how all the Kitty Fiddler vans, they went away into the time warp into the...
And let's not forget that it all led back to the Dark Tower world.
Exactly,
went to the Gilead.
It's where all the Kitty Fiddler vans ended up.
It's the 1900.
God, that'd be an amazing sketch. It's like, I'm going to buy a van. Oh, you planning on molesting some kids?
That could be an SNL sketch.
Huh?
Why is that a funny sketch?
Just imagine the car salesman at that lot.
Like they're constantly trying to call the cops, but he's like, no, I want a van. I don't find
Kitty Fiddling funny, but to go into a lot to buy,
you
a
have
Kitty
to say
Fiddling
that.
Van. Well, I want to go ahead and make sure that
I just want to be clear.
I don't find
child molestation reprehensible, But here's a joke I'm going to make about it.
But I still think this sketch would be great.
I don't think it's funny, but, but I can make jokes that are funny about it.
But when Don Johnson is on SNL, they really need to give him that sketch.
the kitty fiddler car salesman.
The car salesman.
Hey, what you want here is you don't want a van with windows on the side. You don't want to be able to see in or out. Give them hope.
So one question I had was I was thinking about like seeing a dead body. People in movies puke immediately. Do you think that would be, Brian, I know that would probably not be you've seen a lot of dead things. Drew, do you think you would puke almost immediately on seeing like a decomposing dead body?
Well, I mean, I've seen human dead bodies too.
Yeah, you have. But fresh, like you haven't seen like.
By me.
Yeah, it was on a trip with three guys, the other guys. Yeah.
I don't know. It's one of those things that, it's like one of those things in movies that you always see where people act a certain way. And you sit there and say, I'm not going to act that way, but I have no idea. Yeah. Never been in that situation.
I can promise you that what they would puke from was not the sight of the dead body.
The smell,
But it'd be the smell.
Oh, yeah. Oh, certainly. Yeah. Yeah, certainly.
So, describe
like the immediate after you, the only thing I get is in the movies where someone immediately kills someone and immediately pukes after they've done that act, I could kind of get. Otherwise, just seeing a dead body, I don't think would make me puke unless it's been a dead body that's been there for a while. And then there's a chance. There's some gagging. Some gagging going on.
I gag pretty easily, so I think I'd guarantee I'd puke.
Kyler, next time you're down here, I want you to come to work with me.
Nope. Nope. A whole nope. I would never eat meat again.
Do you want to be a vegetarian?
So then you'd have stopped him. I like how you'd have stopped him from drinking and eating meat.
Did I stop Tyler?
No, you didn't.
it was the morning I woke up with. I'm off.
I don't ever want to do this again.
I haven't watched The Big Lebowski again either. I'm kidding.
You turned him off of you, Brian. Turned him off of
drinking.
My
and
favorite
eating
things
meat.
Yeah.
And The Big Lebowski.
My three favorite things.
The trifecta. I'd get them off of fish, chicken. I'd get them off fish, chicken, and red meat. It'd be fine.
Gross. Chicken,
Hey, listen, here's the thing is that when a cow dies, it smells like steak.
Gross.
When it dies?
Well, when they come into the lab, when you cut them open.
Like raw meat?
I mean, lots of times they're put down, so we don't usually get them when they, I mean, the thing about like the agricultural business is they're very immune to the whole idea of like, it's not like your dog or your cat or your personal animal who passes.
It was grown.
It was grown for a reason. It's there for a financial reason. Right. So when they come in, they're very unattached. So they will like go, hey, if it dies and it's been there for a day, they're like, fuck it, we'll just bury it. We're not gonna just waste the money on that. But if it dies suddenly or they have to put it down, they will bring it in for necropsy. And when you cut into them, if it's fresh, it smells exactly like what you get a steak out of
Thank you.
Butchers from.
Yeah, makes sense.
It's food. I mean, that's what it is. Like, there's nothing.
I know,
wrong with it.
No. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with like your job, and that's there's nothing wrong with any of that.
It's fine.
But what I'm saying is, I don't want to smell it and then have that association. Like, I fully understand that what I eat came from a thing that once walked around and mooed, but I don't necessarily want to smell what the putrefying version of that is. Does that make sense? Like.
I understand what you're saying, but what I'm saying is that it's not usually putrefying, and the smell you have when you take that meat out of the package is the smell of dead meat.
But see, I would have a different association because...
Tyler, it's the smell of dead meat.
I know that, but what I'm saying is when I bring it home from the deli, it is a different... like, I have a cognitive dissonance where I'm like, I'm buying this because it's food that is grown somewhere. If I went to where you cut up dead bodies of things, I would be like... Oh, this is the other side of that. Now I have to forever associate the two things.
That's interesting you say that because I have the opposite effect. It's like it's kind of like, well, I understand where this all comes from, and I'm fine with that.
Yeah, but you also have a lot of experience with it, and I don't.
With death.
Well, come to work with us.
Nope. Whole lot of nope.
Here you're coming in.
I respect your job. I'm not going
to
go in there.
I respect you, but I don't have to talk
like
to you.
Yeah. So I kept waiting for Art to show up and understand this is the first place that he had to deal with the Dixie Mafia before he had to deal with Raylan later on.
Nice.
It did feel like it was like the Dixie Mafia they were dealing with. Like, I guess the Texas.
Is that a Justified reference?
It is. Like the Texas, branch of them. I felt that's really who they were dealing with there.
They make that mafia seem so much worse than I had imagined in my head because right. of the scene with the baseball bat. That was absolutely horrifying. And I knew as soon as they open up the trunk of that Yugo and pulled out the videotape labeled batting practice, I knew what was going to happen.
Right. Yeah.
I knew it wasn't going to be like log jamming where there was just a funny pun related to it in a porn. I knew batting practice. I knew what it was going to end with. And
the idea that, what disturbs me is like, were all those tapes the same tape or were they all different?
They versions? Were all different.
They were different.
They were all different. That's the horrifying thing is that they're filled with, I mean, that's where it turns into 8mm. That movie becomes equal parts 8mm and Spring Breakers, like the very last scene of Spring Breakers to me at that moment. Like from the moment they find that tape, the scene, those scenes are why I love the movie even more. That's where it topped it, where I was like, this is one of my favorite movies we've watched for the podcast. When Sam Shepard's taking a shower or whatever he's doing, and then they're watching it. Is he I think he's showering, right? And he comes out, what have you been watching? And then they let him watch it by himself. And there's just this wide shot of them sitting outside, and you just hear things breaking.
Yeah.
And it's funny, but also sad. Like, it has an immense sadness to it, but it's also a hilarious visual gag as well. And none of the other movies he's done has pulled it off.
What's great about it is that you realize, like, this guy is looking for his son, who he hasn't seen since he was probably 4.
He said...
Because he said he was about Michael C. Hall's son's age when he left. So you know, it's like all that time in prison, he's probably built up how great his kid is. You know, this young little boy who probably, you know, grew up to be great, and then finds out that his son is just a shit heel.
It's worse than he is, because he still has this weird humanity. He has that weird honor code.
Yeah.
He's that honor code criminal kind of deal, who still sees what they're doing as being bad.
Right. Yeah. Like, I imagine that. Do they ever tell you what Sam Shepard was in for?
No, I don't think so.
I imagine he's in there for either B&E or. It's
armed robbery.
Armed robbery, or even like aggravated assault. Like he beat somebody up in a bar fight.
Like Bruce Springsteen style crimes. Like the things that Bruce Springsteen would write about.
He is the guy from Atlantic City who got caught up in the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I did my time.
Yeah.
I understand. This is what life is. This is the dice that life has rolled me. This is what I'm going to deal with.
Yeah.
Sam Shepard is an acclaimed playwright and also an unquestionable badass.
I know.
like, there wasn't a part of me that was like, Sam Shepard's like, no, oh, Jesus, he's so scary. And it was pretty impressive.
He sort of calls forth that, like, Ernest Hemingway and, like, Hunter S. Thompson, like, workman-like writer who's has that side but is also just hard as nails, you know, and he definitely has that. Like James Lee Burke and what's his name? Shit, the guy who
Harrison.
And the guy Johnny Likes, who he had a typewriter on two boards in the woods. That's how he would write. He died a few years ago. Fuck, what's his name? I don't remember. But yeah, just like these.
Was that
tough,
not Harrison? That's what I was thinking.
That's not no. It wasn't Jim Harrison. It was another writer. I don't remember. But
McCarthy.
I don't think he's tough. I just think he writes about tough people. Because if you see him talk, he's just like.
I think you're right. I read an article. I read a like top 20 things you didn't know about Cormac McCarthy the other day, and I was like, whoa, wow, he's just.
What are they? Like, what are some of them? What is one thing?
He writes on a typewriter.
Okay, that doesn't
make
him tough.
His typewriter got auctioned off for something, and his original typewriter he wrote on for 30 years got auctioned off, and then he went and just a friend of his had a typewriter company make the exact same typewriter. Writer for him.
Wow.
So he could write on. See what else.
He was poor for a really long time. Like his first dozen novels did not sell well at all. Like he is acclaimed now, but from 1972 to like 2005, nobody knew who he was. I mean, very few people did.
I mean, I remember The Road is where he just exploded.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew people had talked to me before that, but The Road is where he just blew up.
Because of Oprah.
Still,
yeah, that helped. Yeah.
Yeah, because she make it her book of like 2007 or something like that? Still, probably one of the, like, if not the most depressing book I've ever read. I'm not going to, I think when I went through a real deep depression probably 5 years ago, 4 years ago. I'm not joking. I think the road is what like.
It just tipped you over.
It was like, probably, I was already there and I read that. I was like, oh, shit. And all I.
life is shit. I'm just going to put on a bathrobe for a month.
That last paragraph where he just describes the fish in the water and how it used to be, I was like, oh, God, why is there so much evil in the world? And it was just like,
that book is dork.
Tipping point. It is dork.
Reading that at the same time. I can't separate reading that and Hannibal Rising at this point. I remember reading them in the same
two very
place.
Different books.
It was sitting in the same chair in the same apartment at that point. And so those two books are inextricably linked, and they're not by any means any close in quality.
At the film festival, one of the volunteers was like, most of the volunteers were very they were either first year like college students, this is what like their thing was, right. Or they were like either late high school. One of the girls had the road and she had just started it. I was like, oh, are you ready to be depressed?
So wasn't somebody reading it as well at the did you say the film festival this year?
Yeah, I did.
Sorry. God, I just zoned out.
She out there reading
I zoned out for a second. I was thinking you were talking about something about college. Yeah, no, the book is dark, and I feel like this movie fits oddly into Cormac McCarthy's view of the world.
Totally. I could totally see this being in that same, his idea of what things are.
Well, mentioned No Country. I mean, I could see, like, in another part of the state is where Anton Chigurh is at this point while this is going on.
Like, in this same universe and world and year, like, I still think this movie is infinitely more optimistic than No Country for Old Men is.
Yeah, I can see that, yeah.
I mean, there is still light at the end of the tunnel here, and
yeah,
well, and you know, at the end of it all, the good guys win.
Yeah,
and the good guys might not be all good, but the bad guys,
right? But it's like they're bad guys, but the worst guys lose.
Yeah,
so I mean, you know, you got to take your lesser of two evils.
Well, did the cops ever get theirs?
No,
but did the cops do anything bad?
Yes.
They
cover
in
up a murder.
Thing up.
But were they setting it up for the feds? That's what I like. Were they setting this up for the witness protection program, which is what he was in?
Right, to protect, but still to protect this. I mean, it's still
protecting.
There's
got to
be.
I see what you're saying too.
There was like, still money crossing the table from the.
And not just that, but the cops did try to get Sam Shepard run over by a train. So there is that too.
Well, there's also that
to kill the other guy's family and then run over by a train.
Right.
Although they did say we were going to protect him. I did love that scene. Was like. That whole scene in the house with that was like a scene from like Halloween 5.
Yeah,
that's what that was when they're in the house.
When
he sees the
police officer down, you're like, oh shit, he's in the house.
Yeah, I mean it was very much. That's what I thought. That's the first thing that jumped in my head was Halloween. I guess it was 5. I think. Yeah, when they go to the cop's family's house, the girlfriend's house.
Oh right, yeah. Right. Yeah. And there was at the very end there was the. I was just talking to Drew and Gene about this, but the idea that like there was still that touching moment where Sam Shepard was like, "Tyler, you look super creepy right now."
You look the video has degraded so that it looks like
it's just black in the background.
Well, your video, like I can only see your eyes, noses, and cheeks. Like your mouths are completely black, so it's just
like the world has disappeared behind you. There is no light whatsoever.
But you were
so it's like a Cormac McCarthy novel, is what you're saying.
It evolved into a Cormac McCarthy novel.
I'm going to go turn on a light behind me. No, but talk about... Finish up what you're saying.
There's the scene where the Sam Shepard has shot this kid that's his son and explained to the kid that, hey, I am your, you know, I'm your dad. They go through the little gun battle, and then the kid is, the kid looks at him, and like right before Sam Shepard shoots him again, says, "Are you really my dad?" And then it becomes like a touching moment where the kid's like, "Are you know, after all this, are you really my dad?"
And but he doesn't seem to give a shit to me, the son.
Yeah, well, I mean, how much time do you have to give a shit when you've just been assaulted with, you know, it's just been a shootout?
That's got to be confusing.
No, right. That's what I'm saying. It's like it's all confusing. Like I've learned all this new information.
This guy has just shot me and also said he's my dad. He's my da.
But also, I'm a pretty big piece of shit too.
Yeah, like I can't figure out the morality of this movie because they go far enough in painting the son as like okay, I get he has to do some pretty heinous shit for the dad to say. I'm gonna kill him.
Well, he does, yeah, he does do some heinous shit.
So, and I understand that, but it also makes it seem like, well, yeah, that's a foregone conclusion at this point. You know, I don't know. I mean, I guess I get that. I get that that's the point of the movie is to get them to that end scene, like to get them to the point where they kill the son. But at the same time,
Serbian film-esque, I think.
Without the fucking the kid.
Without all the horrible things.
Without all the fucking.
But the morality, I mean, in talking about it, I guess I see why the morality is there. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know how I feel about the way, I get it. Like, they want to make these people super bad so that we feel justified in killing them. But at the same time, did we have to go that far? I don't know. Maybe, maybe not.
And it's what's also very engrossing about the movie too is that, you know, Michael C. Hall seems like he leads a pretty dull life before this. Like, right. All of a sudden he has a break in, kills a man, then he's
the talk of the town.
He's thrust into the situation.
Then, attacked in his own home. Someone's trying to kill him, and then all of a sudden he watches a snuff film basically, and he can't. Like, he can't go back to his regular life. That's all he's like. All he can think about is being with those, like Don Johnson and Sam Shepard. He's just like, it's just pulling.
It's like
him.
Jaws.
But he got two new best friends though. That was awesome.
He did.
Did you know they hung out afterwards?
Oh man, they drank so many beers.
I want to see the Hurt Locker moment where he's sort of going back through his he's living his life and doing the day-to-day sort of minutia, and then decides to become a vigilante bounty hunter again. I could see this spawning a sequel with him and Don Johnson, kind of like the Devil's Rejects.
He should be like, it should be like a scene at the end of The Dark Knight Rises too, where he goes and picks up a bag that was left for him by Sam Shepard. And the lady's like, oh, it's under your real name. You should use it. I like it better. Like, what's your real name? Deathstroke.
Well, it was August Osage County.
Oh, is that what it is?
That was a sequel, yeah. Sam Shepard was in it. You didn't see it?
I didn't see August Osage County.
It's terrible. Don't go see
it. I imagine.
We just ran terrible. Tyler off, apparently.
Yeah, he just like left the room.
Just ran Tyler off. Hey guys, this is the horrible podcast.
Hey, let's talk bad about Tyler. He will never know how much
he
bad
doesn't
things
actually
say,
listen to the whole thing.
Yeah, he doesn't. He's just not going to edit it. Listen.
Yeah.
Guys, Tyler is such a pussy. He won't even drink anymore. I hate sober people.
But I did.
Drew's like, I'm not gonna touch that with a 10-foot pole.
I don't know. It's
So yeah, like Tyler and I are like super best friends.
Exactly.
Now,
really, it's awesome guy.
Hey, I really hope he doesn't go back and listen to what we said, which he totally will now.
I've been here the whole time. What are you talking about?
Magic.
The magic of editing.
Right. I don't know if it's worse. I don't know if it's worse now that he's turned the light on. Now he's like all dark. He's like
a blue
shadow. Chippy from the Tim and Eric's Awesome Show. Here's my Chippy.
Is that better?
Well, now what I'm afraid of is there's just enough space over his shoulder that something's going to come in behind him that we're going to see and have to, you know, Tyler, behind you!
Tyler, the knife is coming down.
We've seen way too many horror movies.
Yeah, this is the perfect.
But you know, like, I bought a tent recently, and like the only thing I think about is like all the bad things that are going to happen in the woods. It's like, oh, this is where murders happen, Jackson.
It's my first thought was Jason Goes to Hell, where the lady is fucking the guy, as is wont to do in Jason movies, and then he sticks the like signpost through her and then rips her open through the shoulder there, like totally improbable for a human being to do, but he just does it. There's that. There are the children of not children of the Bodom killings. There are those, and
most is based on.
There is the Blair Witch Project. Just lots of tense.
Any
stuff.
Numerous nightmare scenarios that could happen in the woods.
And being in the woods is scary. I mean, not just like camping out at a campground, but being on, say, the Appalachian Trail, dozens of miles from society, and just all of the things you hear in the middle of the night are absolutely terrifying.
We honestly, we watch the worst, though, you realize.
Oh, yeah. What the worst is...
Don't go in the woods.
Don't go in the woods.
Yes, that is the worst.
Are people breaking into goth songs? And, yeah. Or even worse than that would be... who's the guy who directed it?
Vincent D'Onofrio.
Vincent D'Onofrio. oh my God! Look at Tyler. Tyler just put the frou-frou-iest dog.
I just ruined this podcast.
Jesus, the frou-frou-iest dog in the world just had to come into the room.
Oh, Kate's dog.
Hey, Tyler, how you doing, buddy?
If you rewind 30 seconds, you can hear her shaking. I forgot to close the door. So there she was.
What
you
doing here, buddy? That was the scary movie moment. She just needed to be bigger so we could see her behind your shoulder.
Right.
Just like rising up behind my shoulder. So I say watch Cold in July multiple times. Just watch it and rewatch it.
Yeah, totally. Just technically, totally watch Cold in July, which is odd. It's not on iTunes to rent anymore. So I imagine that means
preparing for a DVD release.
Maybe it's in the transition stage of coming out. But awesome. I kind of wish we'd gotten to it sooner so you guys could rent it. But when it comes out, wherever it comes out, definitely get to it.
But also, you can do battery.
Battery. Yeah. Weird. I was going to say that.
Just come out or about to come out on Blu-ray. It's very close.
I'm waiting.
It's not already out. It's very close.
It's very close to coming out. Yeah, the battery comes out here soon. I can look at my receipt. I know I'm supposed to have it coming soon, but I haven't got a receipt that says your Scream Factory order has shipped.
You should have gotten the German version. It sounds even better.
Does it?
Well, I mean, just, yeah.
Just because German sounds better?
Well, yeah. No.
German, the worst language.
That's actually how they advertise it now. German, the worst language.
German. So what people do you have in your throat?
And hipsters will learn it ironically now. Like, it's the worst language, so I guess I'm going to learn it. Whatever.
I talked to a friend today who lives in Southern California, and he was saying that he sends his kid to a Mandarin kindergarten. I was like, is that an orange-flavored kindergarten?
God.
Or is that in preparation for the eventual Chinese takeover? And he said the latter, and he said that in, there are, they have different kindergartens, a lot of which stretch the Chinese, and he sends his kid to that, so they learn Chinese now. I'm like, geez. Yeah.
They need to.
America, what's going on, man?
God, Brian, you're going to become the Michael C. Hall from Cold in July of this podcast.
America.
Worse, you're going to become the Anthony Michael Hall of this podcast.
He's already that.
Yeah, I'm already that. Come on, guys.
So, yeah, I say watch that movie. Watch Cold in July.
Yeah, watch Cold in July.
Because you're going to want to rewatch it. I already want to rewatch it. I wish this movie had come out when I was in college, because I would be watching it all the time.
Follow us on Twitter, HorriblePeakCast. Find us at thehorriblepodcast.com.
Send us an email at wolfmansgotnards@thehorriblepodcast.com.
You know, I've noticed a lot of people interacting with us more on Twitter. I like it.
Yeah, totes.
That's much better. Look at the German title.
Ben and Mickey versus the Dead. That is a good title.
That
is
a great title.
All right, guys. So I'm Brian.
I'm Tyler.
And I'm Drew.
And thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next time.